Welcome. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Deep State. Here on The Deep State, we go deep into stories that the mainstream media doesn't want you to know. The Deep State imprisoned me once upon a time. Well, now we're going after the Deep State. I want to bring on now Tim Gordon. Tim is a popular Catholic YouTuber, and he hosts the show Rules for Retrogrades. He's also the author of a whole bunch of books. How has your legal training shaped your view of, well, American constitutional order, American society, even our political system today?
Yeah, I went to the place where I could study the most constitutional law because I was working at a PhD at a pontifical school in Rome. My first daughter was born there with many brain surgeries needed. So we came home and I put aside the PhD for the time, and I was like, I guess I'll need to do something kind of related to making arguments. So I went to law school. But I didn't really want to just do normal law, so I went to the place where I could study the Constitution most, because I do love the American Constitution, even though that's out of fashion now, even among right-wingers, particularly Catholic sort of dissident right-wingers. They think it's – they don't think there's anything redeeming about it. I love the Constitution. I love constitutional history. And the beautiful thing about the U.S. Constitution that no one sings anymore – is that it, you know, really up until the Civil War, it really and truly was a partly consolidated and a partly confederated document. Now, this is a term that Madison uses in Federalists, I think, 39 and 51, where if you look at what the Articles of Confederation were, which I like, that was purely confederation. Confederation, FOTUS, is a Latin term meaning treaty government, basically the kind of government where it's just a league of friendship that you band together during wartime. For example, under the Articles of Confederation, for those 12 or 13 years when we fought the war for the first half of the time, there were really 13 separate countries. And of course, I like the size of those 13 separate countries more than a continent-sized republic. It's a Republican name only when it's that large. And they only had one branch of government. They only had one Congress, another treaty government term. Congress is not a republic term. It's a treaty gov term. And they met once a year in the summer. And the other branches were all just state branches. The judiciary and the executives were just gubernatorial. And so they really were truly 100% confederated. 13 countries coming together to be a sort of country once a year or to fight wars. That's pure confederation.
Yes.
Pure consolidation is what I would say we've had after the Civil War. The 14th Amendment, which was ratified in 1868, made us purely consolidated, whatever you want to call it. It's basically globalism, tyranny, you know. Under FDR, you had like Washington, D.C. telling Honolulu wheat farmers they can't eat their own wheat 5,000 miles away. Right. This is pure tyranny. That pure consolidation means you're governed from half a world away. And it's all one consolidated big kind of imperial big government. But the experiment that was truly unique in America, they called it imperio in imperium, was having two layers of government, having a federal layer of the state rule where all the sexy powers were there locally, and a national level, you know, from Washington, D.C., where it was just, if you look at Article 1, Section 8 of our Constitution, these are the scant 15 or so things that the National Congress was allowed to legislate. And they weren't the sexy, moralistic powers described in the 10th Amendment. Everything else was left to the local powers, to the what at the time was called federal powers. Now we use the term in an opposite way, state rule. And it was really remarkable, and it really worked. You know, the anti-federalists, who are my favorite of the founders, warned, well, one side's going to preponderate over the other, and it will probably be the national side, which is what happened after the Civil War with the 14th Amendment. But it was really remarkable what these geniuses did when they took us from the Articles of Confederation to the Constitution, which really did have two sort of empires within an empire, state legislatures within the national legislature, ruling people until the Civil War. So I guess ultimately the anti-federalists were right, but I would say, and I probably would favor something more like an Articles of Confederation, but to do even the part confederated, part consolidated government of the first 80 years of constitutional rule would suit me.
Where do you think the disconnect lies between America's founding principles and today's Catholic Church. Is there daylight between the two?
There's a lot. That's what my book's about. And yeah. I'm coming out with a documentary about the book. People believe in their natural rights, life, liberty, property, man. I mean, that's a Catholic idea. John Locke was borrowing from Bellarmine and Suarez. Subsidiarity, what I keep recurring to throughout this entire interview, you know, the local rule, that's a natural law principle. Virtue ethics, you know, all of those WASP founders, you know, who under Martin Luther rejected the idea of virtue.
Yes.
They all kept saying, it doesn't matter how good a constitution you get, unless it's a virtuous people, the constitution's just straw. So they believed in Aristotelian virtue ethics. Proper church-state relations. Did you know, John, that even after the First Amendment was ratified with the Bill of Rights in 1791, did you know that they presumed that all of the 13 states would have an established sect of Christianity? And 9 of the 13 did.
I did not know that. Akin to yes. A Church of England, you're saying.
No, they were. It was up to the state legislature which
wow.
sect of Christianity would be the official state. Yeah,
oh,
a lot of people
I see.
Don't know
good
that.
Grief. No, I did not know that.
No, it was good. That's how it's supposed. So that they reversed this in a case called Everson versus Board of Ed in 1948. It was literally 7 or 8 Freemasons on SCOTUS. They just said that the First Amendment meant the exact opposite of what it ever meant. When it says the Establishment Clause that shall respect no establishment of religion, this was actually more often called the Disestablishment Clause. So Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What that meant is Congress was not allowed to disestablish any of the existent state establishments.
Wow.
Of, you know, check the Carfax on that, everybody. That was what the First Amendment was geared to do. And it always just meant there can be no national branch of Christianity. It won't be Catholicism. It won't be Orthodoxy. It won't be one of the 40,000 types of Protestantism nationally for all the states. But the states were supposed to. Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. So is that why we say, oh, back in the day at the founding of the Republic, Maryland was a Catholic state, Rhode Island was a Catholic state, Massachusetts was a Puritan state? Is that what that stems from?
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, interestingly enough, Maryland was not one of the established states, but 9 of the 13 were. Yeah, they were Maryland was very Catholic, but it did not have an establishment. But yes, the northern states were all some form of covenantalism, you
wow.
know, and the southern states were all Anglican, mm-hmm. the ones that had it. It was 9 out of the 13. And the founders, when Madison wrote this, he really assumed that 12 of the 13 wouldn't. I think he thought Rhode Island wouldn't, but he thought it would be 12 of the 13. But those state establishments were intact into the 1800s. And they could, it was up to the individual state legislature whether they would have an official sect of Christianity. And they sort of slowly disestablished themselves. But the point was, it was 1948 when the First Amendment got incorporated, if you know what incorporation doctrine is, by the 14th Amendment, that they just, Supreme Court now, reversed the meaning of this and said, oh, the Establishment Clause means that the individual states are not allowed to have establishments. No, it just meant there can be no national establishment, A, and B, that the Congress cannot disestablish the state establishments. And SCOTUS was doing just what Congress was always forbidden to do, to disestablish state establishments. So people have been completely brainwashed to the exact opposite, the diametrical opposite of what the point of the First Amendment was.
We seem to be living in an increasingly confused age. And at the same time, perhaps as a response to this state of confusion, people are also trying to live more faithfully or in closer contact with the church of their roots. What do you think the most important habit is for someone trying to live more faithfully in a confused age like this?
That's interesting. I would say, I mean, if you're a Christian, what's been in the water the last 5 years is Christians are just realizing that the first millennium of Christianity involved bishops in an apostolic lineage, the seven sacraments, church, you know, that this 90s idea, which only left Protestantism standing, of, well, I love the faith, but I hate religion. Now, you'd even hear a lot of Protestants say that, yeah. Non-denominationals. It's the exact opposite. People are connecting with, again, nature, and nature calls us to worship, you know, so actually worshiping the real presence of the Eucharist is the first thing we're called to. There's really, I mean, if you think of the difference between the actual apostles and you and I, they got to walk with Jesus. Mm. Now they got to be around him. Well, so do you and I in the form of, you know, Eucharistic devotion or Eucharistic consumption with the Blessed Host. And it definitely, I'm sure, phenomenologically feels a little different than it did to walk with Jesus. But people are understanding now that just reading the true stories in the New Testament of Jesus is not enough. Okay, so I guess I kind of answered a slightly different question than you asked.
That's okay.
That's why there's this flooding of former Protestants into apostolic Christianity, whether Orthodox or Catholic. Okay, and the way that an Orthodox or a Catholic can stay close to his faith is, one, to practice the sacraments, which really, you know, you don't go get rebaptized, you don't go get reconfirmed, but the practice of the sacraments means a daily pattern, a quotidian pattern of confession, communion, confession, communion. I mean, a weekly pattern at least, right? You need to go to confession to receive communion. You need to be receiving communion. That keeps you in a state of grace, and it's just easier to be good.
Yeah.
And any practicing Christian will tell you it makes it easier to be good. And then, of course, you know, to follow the commands, faith without works is dead. But I would say the practice of the sacraments is what keeps apostolic Christians faithful, and it's what's attracting non-apostolic Christians into our ranks.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. There's a debate taking place mostly in the state of Michigan today, to a slightly lesser extent in the state of New Jersey, among Muslims, American citizens. And the debate is over whether or not Islam allows Muslims to participate in the political process. Of course it does. But this is something that is being genuinely debated. How do you think Catholics should be engaging in politics without becoming consumed by partisanship? Is it possible for Catholics to be on both sides in a system that is really a duopoly?
Well, it is. I mean, not in the sense that it would, the direct sense that it would be in the days of the Holy Roman Empire.
Sure.
But in a real sense, I'll give you an answer that's consistent with the themes and even the diction of earlier parts of this interview. So what more evils of the 14th Amendment, right, 1868, 14th Amendment, is whereas before, hopefully none of these words get your channel a strike or anything like that, but contraception,
yep,
abortion, prawn, as they call it on the internet, sodomy, gay marriage, take these five things, right, that no Christian should be supporting directly or indirectly.
Yeah.
Those were, in red states, legislatively outlawed, as anyone could imagine. They were not allowed in 30 to 35 of the states, depending on the issue. Literally, I'm going through it now. Contraception, abortion, pornography, sodomy, gay marriage. So at the level of the so-called culture war, what the left did is they used the 14th Amendment, which really supplanted the Constitution, which allowed states to decide for themselves, you know, to regulate health, welfare, safety, moral security. Those states decided for themselves. Well, what the 14th Amendment did through the jurisprudence was it literally made it illegal to illegalize those things across all 50 states. I don't know if you knew that. I once debated Josh Hammer. And he said, oh, I'm like you. I don't like that. I said, no, you believe in something like Adrian Vermeule's constitutionalism. You have to own these things even if you don't like them. Literally, the case Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965 banned the banning of contraception in all 50 states. So the 30 to 35 states where it was illegal to have contraception, they banned the banning in Griswold under 14th Amendment jurisprudence. In 1969, Stanley versus Georgia, they banned the banning through this case, Supreme Court case, of pornography in those red states where it was illegal. They made it illegal to illegalize it. 1973, of course, Roe did the same, banned the banning of abortion. 2002 or something was Lawrence versus Texas. They banned the banning of sodomy in the red states. And in Obergefell, which I think was 2015, they banned the banning of gay marriage in those states. So this is what I keep talking about. A Catholic has to just look at that beautiful encyclical that we have by Pope Pius XI in 1931, very famous because it enshrines the foremost Catholic political principle, which is called subsidiarity, which means it was beautiful. It was really well enshrined in the American Constitution prior to the 14th Amendment. It enabled the red states, which is where you or I should try to live to bring our families, our wives and children, to decide for themselves. There wasn't one national policy on these five obvious Christian evils. Well, the Supreme Court, being Masonic, one by one in court cases, undid that. They banned the banning of these things. So I think it's not LARPy at all to understand the way the Constitution actually works. It's not LARPy at all for a Catholic or an Orthodox or a Protestant to say, this is bad. It should be more than legal. It should be great, especially in a red state, for all of the, you know, majority 60%+ of the people to say, we don't want contraception, abortion, sodomy, gay marriage, etc. And that's the kind of stuff that people need to not only know their faith for, but they need to know the Constitution and the workings of federalism in order to accomplish.
Yeah. You are quite a prolific writer. What books are you working on right now?
Right now, I am working on, I've also become a filmmaker, and I'm working on doing for my first book, Catholic Republic, which I've been talking about quite a bit today, into a documentary. I have some big backers on that. I won't say who yet, but it's a similar project to what I did with regard to my book, The Case for Patriarchy. I turned that one into the now Candace Owens film called What a Woman Is. You can go see it on CandaceOwens.com. It's basically that book turned into an hour and a half documentary. I'm working on doing the same with my book, Catholic Republic, explaining a lot of the things we've talked about here today. I wrote 5 books in 5 years, so I got kind of burnt out, and you know, so now I'm taking on a different thing, and I have a podcast that I go 3 times a week on YouTube, you know, Rules for Retrogrades, Timothy Gordon. So it keeps me pretty busy with my 8 kids and my wife.
What do you hope readers or listeners are able to take away after hearing you speak? When you go out there, especially at universities, what is the message that you hope lands the best with people?
Just act natural. You know, I'm from Bakersfield, California. Buck Owens once sang, act natural. That, you know, the philosophy, having the proper philosophy of nature enables us to be, like we've kept recurring to, traditional where it's natural, and to pray for tradition when it's out of our hands, to, you know, the old Alcoholics Anonymous prayer, you know, to change what we can, to, as I hope people become retrogrades, you know, dissident right-wingers, to turn back the clock where we can, and to, you know, give it to Jesus where it's truly out of our hands. But a lot is in our hands. Men need to take back over their families, be a lot more involved in both in positive ways in their families, and understand that, you know, the kind of dispensationalism that took over evangelical churches all across America over the last century was co-attended by a kind of feminism and a nominalism and a view of all, you know, men and women are the same. You know, men aren't leaders, women can be leaders. That kind of stuff, that has kept men from reaching out and claiming what's rightfully theirs, and it's messed up whole generations of people to not have strong, loving fathers that are very hands-on and sweet helpmeet mothers that are hands-on in a completely different way. So they can really, that's where they can really make a big difference. And when it comes to politics and culture,
yeah,
vote with your feet, get to a red state, and pray that American federalism comes back, where the states really have self-determination as they were intended to do. That's all you can do, and pray and live in the sacraments.
I'm glad that you brought up the idea of documentaries. I'm working with a prominent Catholic filmmaker right now on two documentaries. One is on the history of the Christians of Gaza. This is something that I think most Americans don't know, is that there has been a Christian presence in Gaza for 2,000 years. There aren't a lot of Christians. It's between 1 and 2%. But if the population of Gaza is, you know, 2 million, we're talking about as many as 40,000 Christians. That's a lot of Christians in a small space. Has it been your experience, Tim, that Americans don't know about the history of Christianity and the wide array of Christian communities around the world, or even more specifically, the Middle East? And one of the other reasons that I bring this up is just this past week, the city of Tehran, the capital of Iran, had the grand opening. There was a soft opening earlier, but the grand opening of a new subway station called Virgin Mary Station. And there is a statue of Virgin Mary. There's a bronze plaque there telling the story of the Virgin Mary, something that most Americans don't know is happening in Iran. What are your experiences as you cross the country meeting with young Christians, especially with young Catholics? I assume Orthodox Christians also attend your talks. Are people aware that these ancient Christian communities still exist?
Yeah, I think Orthodox are more, and I do have an Orthodox following, are more aware of it. Catholics are becoming increasingly aware of it with the conflict in Iran.
Yes.
Over the last 3 years, and they need to become more aware of it. I mean, I was a church history teacher for 10 years, and I mean, Catholics aren't even aware of their rich history, qua Rome and qua Europe, let alone the Middle East. So, and of course, they're so underrepresented there, Christians, that it's really good work. I think I can guess which filmmaker you're working with to make that one. And that, man, what an important documentary that should be, because when Americans have been caught up in the false Hegelian dialectic of who do you support, Muslims or Jews in the Middle East, it's like Christians is who I want to support in the Middle East. And I don't care, Protestant, Orthodox, Catholic.
Agreed.
Any Christian in the Middle East is on my team, and that's who I want to support. And that's the dollars and love and prayers that I want to send over there. So it is interesting, though, that if you compare, I didn't know that there was the Holy Virgin Mary train station in Tehran, but the Muslims do, I will say, think she's the holiest woman. They think she was the mother, a virgin, perpetual virgin. They think she was the mother of, they rightly believe she was the mother of the Messiah. They just, of course, don't believe that the Messiah was also God. But they have, and it violates Sharia law in most of their countries to say something nasty about Mary. So it's interesting. And many converts come into Catholicism from Our Lady of Zatoun, Egypt. They have a profound love that's very workable toward conversion in regard to the Blessed Virgin Mary.
And thank you for watching. This is The Deep State. And remember, keep asking us the questions the government wants you to ignore. I'm John Kiriakou, and we'll see you next time.